how those things happen. Last time we had discussed healing the Sabbath and some of the things, disciples being questioned about those things. And today we begin with the selection of 12 apostles. We've been talking about this for a while. Jesus' ministry has been going on for a year or a little bit over a year at this time, and he's just now getting down to choosing the 12 apostles. As we'll see again today, a little bit later on, we've not even got to the Sermon on the Mount yet. And we're going to talk about that a little bit today briefly, though, because it's such a big section. But all the things we've seen him do so far, the healing and so forth, and the miracles. We're going to see a different kind of miracle maybe today if we get to it as well. That hadn't been done just yet. But he's becoming very popular. People know about him. Not everybody likes him. But he's very popular. People are following him. So with that, the selection of the 12 is found in two places, specifically two places, Mark and Luke. It's mentioned in Matthew, but it's surrounded a different event. They're listed in Acts as well, but the two that we're going to talk about is briefly is Mark and Luke. So, after spending the night in prayer, we find out Jesus calls his disciples to himself, and he selects 12 of them to be his specific apostles. So we know the word apostle means an ambassador or a delegate who is sent on a mission. That's what Jesus is about to do with these. He had many disciples, but these 12 were selected to be sent up for a special or a specific mission. They're going to preach, and they're going to be able to perform miracles. Matthew, as I said, also gives a list of it, but it's a different event. That's in Matthew 10, verses 2 through 4. We won't read that because it's connected with another event. And then Acts 1 and verse 13 is the other one. But the men selected are Simon, who Jesus has nicknamed Peter, and he was Andrew's brother. And of course, there's Andrew, who is Simon's brother. James, the brother of John, the son of Zebedee, and his brother, John. So you have James and John, both the sons of Zebedee, and were nicknamed by Jesus the brothers or sons of thunder. We have Philip, and we have Bartholomew. We have Matthew, who we've already met, also known as Levi. Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus. Simon, who was known as Zealot. Some of your translations will say Canaanite in certain places. Judas, the son of James, also known by Levius, but more commonly known as Thaddeus. So he's known by three different names. And then, of course, Judas Iscariot, who eventually betrays Jesus. Mark chapter 3. I'll be reading these, but basically just reading what I just told you right then, but reading it as the Bible tells us. Begin at verse 13. He went up to on the mountain and called to him those he himself wanted, and they came to him. And he appointed 12 that they might be with him, that they might send out them to preach and to have power to heal sickness and cast out demons. So we see what they're able to do, their purpose. Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to whom he gave the name of Boanerges, that is, sons of thunder. Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Canaanite, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. And they went into a house. Luke chapter 6 is the other account. As we stated over and over, Luke is the book that we're using for our order to put things. Verse 12. It came to pass in those days that he went out to the mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. And when it was day, he called his disciples to himself. And from them he chose 12, whom he also named apostles. Simon, whom he had also named Peter, Andrew, his brother, James and John, Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon called the Zealot, Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who also became a traitor. Any comments about that section? So again, we sound like we're very far into his ministry. He's just now choosing these 12. So it gives us an idea of how much he did. Again, they didn't have newspapers and TV back then, but word of mouth is how things went. People saw stuff. They reported things. They told things. And people know that he's doing wonderful things. Not everybody knows who he is just yet, though. The next section we see is found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and it's some multitudes are going to be healed. We see that Jesus leaves Jerusalem, continues to heal people as he wandered. It's amazing we see how much he actually healed when you read these in order. How much he actually does. Some were healed by merely touching him. We see a little difference here. This too is notable. How many so-called faith healers today are able to heal without even being an active participant in it? People walk by and touch him, and they'd be healed. He drew crowds from Israel, but they were joined by Gentiles from regions surrounding Israel. Both Jew and Gentile wanted to be around him. There were times when he preached from a boat so that the crowds would not press on him as he spoke, because the crowds were so big, they wanted to touch him and get near him and be healed. As he did so, he asked that those who healed him would not announce who he was. For some, it was a matter of demons who cried out in testimony that Jesus was not interested in receiving from them. But for others, Matthew explains, the book of Matthew, when we read it, that it was a fulfillment of Isaiah 42, verses 1 through 5. And we'll see that when we get to Matthew's account. Jesus was not seeking a confrontation with the Jewish leaders, though they were seeking his life. Jesus peaceably withdrew and he continued to do his work. He didn't want to confront them in that way. Nor was he fulfilling the expectations of the Jews who saw their Messiah as a war leader. They wanted something more physical that would stir up Israel and lead them in battle against hated Gentile conquerors, Rome. Instead of crying out against the Gentiles, he actually brought justice and healing to these Gentiles. What may not be readily apparent is that the illusion of a broken and dying people, as we read about, is a reference of Israel and their leaders. They're broken. They're dying. And these are symbols of a weak and dying faith. The Jewish leaders desired to kill Jesus, as we know. Jesus could have pushed that issue, but it wasn't in Israel's best interest. Pushing would have destroyed what little was left of Israel. If Jesus was to win them over to the truth, he had to give them a chance to think about what he had said. Give them a chance to think about the things that they had heard, the things they had seen, time to digest what he had taught them. In the confrontation, Jesus wounded the Pharisees' pride because it was the only way to shake them out of the complacency they were in, to make them aware of their sins. If he was to rub salt into the wound by repeated conflicts, it would not improve the situation. So what does Jesus do? He withdraws. He goes away from them. Not from fear, but again, to give the Pharisees a chance to turn around, to think about those things. His treatment of the Pharisees is an illustration of what Paul stated Christians ought to do for the wayward, as we read about in Galatians 6 and 2 Timothy 2. Again, both Jesus and Paul appear to be weak and timid in their teachings because of this gentle approach. But they had boldness and strength because of the truth they presented. They were not weak. All that can be done is done for the sake of saving a person. Not to allow the weak in faith to remain weak, but to encourage them and give them a chance to grow strong. It was by this means that the gentle treatment of the hostile Jews, which would win the Gentiles over to God. And Jesus would conquer the Gentile world as well, but not, again, not through warfare. Let's read these accounts. Matthew chapter 12. Begin at verse 15. But when Jesus knew it, he withdrew from there. Let's back up to verse 14. And the Pharisees went out and plotted against him how they might destroy him. That's the context. He'd been healed on the Sabbath. But when Jesus knew it, knew this, he withdrew from there, and great multitudes followed him. And he healed them all. Yet he warned them not to make him known, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, "Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved in whom my soul is well pleased, I will put my spirit upon him. And he will declare justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel, nor cry out, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets." Anyways, he just goes about doing his business, doing God's work. "A bruised reed he will not break. Smoking flax he will not quench till he sends forth justice to victory. And in his name Gentiles will trust." He's not going to push the Jews who don't believe. He wants to give them a chance to think about it. Mark chapter 3. Verse 7. But Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great multitude from Galilee followed him, and from Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea and beyond the Jordan, and those from Tyre and Sidon, a great multitude. When they heard how many things he was doing, came to him. And so he told his disciples that a small boat should be kept ready for him because of the multitude, lest they should crush him. For he healed many, so that as many as had afflictions pressed about him to touch him. And the unclean spirits, whenever they saw him, fell down before him and cried out, saying, "You are the Son of God." But he sternly warned them that they should not make known or make him known. Luke chapter 6. Again, these are all the same accounts, told different ways. Verse 17. And he came down with them and stood on a level place with a crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem, from the sea coast of Tyre and Sidon, who came to hear him and healed of their diseases, as well as those who were tormented with unclean spirits. And they were healed. And the whole multitude sought to touch him, for power went out from him and healed them all. Any comments about that section? In our timeline, the next section is the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes. That's recorded in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And it's also recorded in Luke 6. That would take us a long, long time to go through all those and study those. And so I've decided to put it in the timeline here, but let's go to the next point, because that'll be for another lesson on those points. That would take many, many weeks on those. Just told in our timeline, this is back when the Beatitudes and Sermon on the Mount happened. After that, after the Sermon on the Mount, comes a Galilean tour. We're going to see the healing of the centurion servants, what happens next. It's in Matthew and Luke. After concluding his sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus returns to the town of Capernaum, and a centurion there hears that Jesus is in town, and he's heard of him. He knows what he can do. And he goes to see him. Centurions were commanders in the Roman army with about 50 to 100 men under them. This particular centurion had a servant who was dear to him. He was gravely ill, though. Matthew's account, when we read it, tells us that he was paralyzed and in pain. Luke's account tells us he was close to death. Knowing that Jesus had this ability to heal, he went to beg of Jesus the favor of having his servant healed. The man, however, was a Roman, and he knew that Jews did not look favorably upon the Gentiles. He was educated in that. And so rather than approach Jesus directly with his request, he asked the elders of Capernaum to bring his request to him, or for him, I should say. The elders were willing to do so because this man had done many favors for them in the past, including financing the building of a synagogue for him. This was a good man, although not a Jew, was a friend to them. Jesus consents, but as he approaches the man's home, we're going to find the centurion sends out friends to tell Jesus that there was no need for the Lord to come all the way and enter his home. Keep in mind, this is a Gentile. Going by what he's heard, he did not think he was worthy to approach Jesus, let alone have the honor of Jesus coming to his house. He only asked that Jesus declare that his servant be healed, and that would be enough. He's going to be healed. He understood the nature of authority, as we will see, being both a man under authority as well as the commander of men himself. He understands authority well. The centurion knew that Jesus had the authority to speak his will, and he knew it was going to be done. We'll see Jesus' reaction to the centurion's request is interesting, as that Jesus marvels at this faith this man has, this Gentile. Jesus tells the crowd following him that he had not found a faith similar to this, what this Gentile displayed in all of Israel. His faith was great. Jesus knew the hearts of people. He could see beyond outward appearances. That's our limitation. But he could see the strength of this centurion's faith, and he knew that no one among the Jews had a similar faith. This is a great faith. He found it wondrous. Jesus states that this would continue to be the case. As he's talking to his disciples that are around him, many would come from distant countries to become believers and will one day sit with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in heaven. But many of the Jews will be rejected because of their lack of faith. So he praises this man at the same time in a slight rebuke to the Jews. When the centurion's friends returned, they found the servant healed that very hour. Jesus had the power to speak it, and it was. As the centurion knew, Jesus did not need to be physically present for healing to take place, nor did Jesus require faith on part of the servant. Now, keep this in mind. He healed the servant, but that servant who he healed didn't have to have faith. The faith came from the friend or the servant's master. Some people became concerned because Matthew's account states that the centurion came directly to Jesus, while Luke's account, we'll see, informs us that he used intermediates to send this word. Because the intermediates were sent by the centurion to say as he directed, it's considered the same as if the centurion himself had done so. And we can understand that from how we talk today too. Matthew chapter 8. Begin at verse 5. Now when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, pleading with him, saying, Lord, my servant is lying at home, paralyzed, dreadfully tormented. Jesus says to him, I will come and heal him. The centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but only speak a word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to this one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard it, he marveled, and said to those who followed, assuredly I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. For I say to you that many will come from east and west, and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness, and there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Jesus said to the centurion, go your way, and as you have believed, so let it be done for you. And his servant was healed that same hour. Luke chapter 7. Verse 1. Now when he concluded all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. And a certain centurion's servant, who was dear to him, was sick and ready to die. So when he heard about Jesus, he sent elders of the Jews to him, pleading with him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they begged him earnestly, saying that the one for whom he should do this was deserving, for he loves our nation and has built us a synagogue. When Jesus went with him, and when he was already not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy that you should enter under my roof. And therefore I did not think myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I am also a man placed under authority, having soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, and turned around and said to the crowd that followed him, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel. And those who were sent returned to the house, found the servant well, who had been sick. Questions about that section or comments? Again, great things he's doing. And it seems like every miracle we see, there's a little something added to it. Sometimes they have faith, sometimes they don't. Sometimes he just has to say a word. Sometimes they can just touch him. But now we're going to see something a little different here. And that Jesus is going to bring back somebody from the dead. Raising of a widow's son. This is found only in Luke. The following day, and according to your version, King James says the following day, the next day. Other versions just say soon afterwards. It was after the fact of what happened. The following day, or soon after there, Jesus left Capernaum, and he entered the town of Nain. Nain is south of Capernaum. So let's get that in your map, where he's from Capernaum. He's going south. This is near where Jesus had gave his Sermon on the Mount. His disciples and a large crowd were following him. That's very important. A large crowd following. Again, providing these witnesses. Again, there's no TV, there's no radio. People have to do word of mouth. But witness to this great event that's about to take place here. As they came close to the gates of the town, there they're met by a funeral procession that's leaving town. So they're coming in, this funeral is coming out. We find that the only son of a widow has died, and he was being carried out for his funeral out of the town. And there was a large crowd, we find out, again, very important, from the town who were attending this funeral, and again, indicating there were many witnesses to see this. We find that Jesus has compassion for the woman and told her there's no need to weep any longer. He touched the open coffin, stopping those carrying it, and he then tells the young man in the coffin to arise. Note that the command was given in no other name but his own, showing his power again. We find the man immediately sets up, begins to speak, and Jesus then gives him back to his mother. The power displayed by Jesus causes the witnesses there both to fear and to glorify God. This is something really amazing, if healing sick wasn't amazing enough. But this wasn't some minor miracle. This is powerful. This was a power such that only great prophets of God or God himself displayed. Further proof of Jesus was who he says he was. Such news obviously could not be contained, obviously. It rapidly spread throughout all Judea and the neighboring regions. Luke chapter 7, verse 11. Now it happened the day after that he went to the city called Nain, and many of his disciples went with him, and a large crowd. And when he came near the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a large crowd from the city was with her. When the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, "Do not weep." Then he came and touched the open coffin, and those who carried him stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." So he who was dead sat up and began to speak. And he presented him to his mother. And fear came upon all, and they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has risen among us, and God has visited his people." And this report about him went throughout all of Judea and all the surrounding region, as you can imagine. You think about that section. So all this is happening, and we forgot about John the Baptist. Where's John the Baptist at? He's still in prison, right? He's not able to hear these things unless it's reported to him through some of his people. We find out here that John the Baptist hears what's going on. He eventually hears this news of Jesus raising the widow's son. And he sends his disciples to ask Jesus a question. Kind of doubt him. Don't forget all that John had done. John knew who he was. John knew who he was the forerunner for. He's the one who baptized Jesus. And yet he's kind of questioning this here. He's not witnessing all this himself. And he says, "Are you the coming one, or do we look for another?" Now, why would he ask that if he's not doubting just a little bit, even though he shouldn't? Seems to be a strange question, again, coming from the man who prepared the way, declared him to be the Messiah at his baptism. But John, like us, was a man. Like all the prophets before him, he was a man. Other prophets had their moments of doubt. Don't forget when Moses had to be convinced to go and free the Israelites, he doubted. Gideon asked for two miracles before he was willing to lead God's people to war. Elijah gave up after Jezebel threatened his life. Jeremiah cursed the day he was born. So again, remember, John's been in prison for quite a while now, and perhaps he thought maybe as the Jews did, many of the Jews, that Jesus would lead Israel in triumph against the Romans in a physical way. Yet in all this time, Jesus hasn't declared himself, nor has there been any apparent move to reestablish the kingdom of Israel. He thought he was delaying, but people were anxious. For John, there's been no rescue. He's still in prison. Maybe he's wondering, why am I still in jail? So is it a wonder that John began maybe to doubt himself? Jesus doesn't answer John's disciples directly. They ask the question, they've been sent from John, "Are you the one? Are we looking for another?" Jesus does not answer them directly. Instead, during that very hour that they asked, he performed more miracles in front of them, those who had come, before the disciples of John, so they could see for themselves. And afterward, he would tell them to return to John and tell them those things that he had witnessed, or they had witnessed. Matthew chapter 11. Begin verse 2. And when John had heard, verse 1. Now it came to pass when Jesus finished commanding his 12 disciples that he departed from there to teach and to preach in their cities. And when John had heard in prison about the works of Christ, he sent two of his disciples and said to him, "Are you the coming one, or do we look for another?" Jesus answered and said to them, "Go and tell John the things which you see or hear and see. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he who is not offended because of me." That's Matthew's account. Luke chapter 7. We'll find the same story, but in a little bit more detail. Or different detail, I should say. Begin at verse 18. Luke 7 and 18. The disciples of John reported to him concerning all these things. This is after he'd just been brought back from the dead. And John, calling two of his disciples to him, sent them to Jesus, saying, "Are you the coming one, or do we look for another?" When the men had come to him, they said, "John the Baptist has sent us to you, saying, 'Are you the coming one, or do we look for another?'" That very hour he cured many of infirmities and afflictions and evil spirits, and to many blind he gave sight. Jesus answered and said to them, "Go and tell John the things you have seen and heard, that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have the gospel preached to them, and blessed is he who is not offended because of me." So he not only, but by hearsay, he gave them proof. They saw it themselves, so they could tell John definitely these are things are happening. Next section is found also in Matthew and Luke, and it's the accomplishments of John. Since these have been sent to him to ask him this question, it gives him an opportunity to talk to those about him, about this John who's in prison. Jesus then asked those following him again about their expectations of John. What was it about him that caused people to journey all the way out to the wilderness to go see him? Because a lot of them had. They've been followers of John, now they're followers of Jesus. And he's recalling their memory back there. Why did you go seek him out in the wilderness when John was there? He asked it as if they expected to find a reed shaken by the wind. That is, were they expecting to find a man who is a timid man who moves whichever direction the political winds blow him or move him? Obviously not. We know John spoke against things like that. It was the word of John's forthrightness and the solid message he had that it was attractive to them. What, Jesus asked, did they expect to see when they got out there? Did they expect to see a well-dressed, wealthy man? Obviously not. Tells them that people in fine clothing are found in palaces, not out in the desert. In the desert, you expect to find a rough, burly type man. These are kind of rhetorical questions. What the people expected to find was a prophet, wearing the clothing of a prophet. But John was more than just a prophet. As we know, he was the forerunner of the Christ, the Messiah. As Jesus pays him the highest of compliments, we see, he says, "There's not been a greater man born up to that time." Again, think about that. That's a big statement. No one has been born before has been as large or greater than this John the Baptist. And yet, despite this great standing, Jesus said that John the Baptist, this greatest of all men of all time, is less than the least person in the coming kingdom of God. The coming kingdom of God. It's not there yet. It's at hand. Despite John's greatness, again, he would never be a Christian. He'd never be part of Christ's kingdom. Think about that. Because he died before. Those in the kingdom would have superior privileges to John. An implication is also given that no one has yet entered Christ's kingdom at this time. Why? Because the kingdom doesn't exist yet. Christ hasn't died yet. It's on its way. It's close. And since the time John first arrived on the scene, people have been trying to force the hand of God concerning the kingdom, trying to speed it up. It's as if these people thought they could enter by their own determination. As we go through the Gospels, we see many examples of this, where they're trying to force Jesus' hand and do things sooner. Let's look at a couple of those examples. John chapter 6. Again, things had to happen. Jesus had to die before his true kingdom came, not the type of kingdom they were expecting. And they were getting a little antsy about it. John 6 and verse 15. "Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force and make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone." So he sees what they're trying to do. We see it over in Matthew chapter 20. Verse 20 beginning. "The mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with their sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. And he said to her, 'What do you wish?' And she said to him, 'Grant those that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and the other on your left, in your kingdom.'" People trying to force things upon him. Back to Luke. Again, people didn't understand the nature of his kingdom yet. 19 and verse 11. Now as they heard these things, he spoke another parable because he was near Jerusalem and because they thought the kingdom of God would appear immediately. Their thoughts were wrong. Same chapter, verse 36. And he went, many spread their clothes on the road. Then as he was now drawing near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice all the mighty works they had seen, saying, Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. Again, they're trying to rush things. The era of the prophets, the Mosaic law, comes to a close with John. John's the last of that era. All before John spoke of the kingdom coming in distant terms, but John spoke as it being close. It was at hand. If people are able to accept it, John is the Elijah who was prophesied to come. Not literal, but spiritually, John was this person. His character was much like Elijah. Still, people have trouble accepting both John and Jesus together. John was isolated in the wilderness and did not socialize with people. And for that, he was called demon-possessed because he was too strict. Jesus, on the other hand, worked among the people and associated with even the lowliest. And for that, he was called a sinner because he was too lenient. God uses all means to reach all people, as Paul stated in 1 Corinthians. With that, let's read the two accounts before we get out of time. Matthew chapter 11. Get verse 7. And as they departed, Jesus began to say to the multitudes concerning John, What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken by the wind? But what did you go out to see? A man clothed in soft garments? Indeed, those who wear soft clothing are in kings' houses. But what did you go out to see? A prophet. Yes, I say to you, and more than a prophet, for this is he of whom it is written, Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare the way before you. Assuredly, I say to you, among those born of women, there is not risen one greater than John the Baptist. But he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. And from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. And if you are willing to receive it, he is Elijah who is to come. He who has ears, let him hear. And to what shall I liken this generation? It is like children sitting in the marketplaces and calling to their companions and saying, We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We mourned to you, and you did not lament. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, Look, a glutton and a winebibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. But wisdom is justified by her children. And then Luke's account, and we'll finish. Luke chapter 7, we'll begin at verse 24. But woe to you who are rich, for you received your... Sorry, Luke chapter 6. Luke 7 and verse 24 begin. When the messengers of John had departed, he began to speak to the multitudes concerning John. What did you go out to the wilderness to see? A reed shaken by the wind? But what did you go out to see? A man clothed in soft garments? Indeed, those who are gorgeously appareled and live in luxury are in king's courts. But what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I say to you, and more than a prophet, this is he of whom it is written, Behold, I will send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way before you. For I say to you, among those born of women, there is not a greater prophet than John the Baptist. But he who is least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. When all the people heard him, even the tax collectors, justified God, having been baptized with the baptism of John. But the Pharisees and lawyers rejected the will of God for themselves, not having been baptized by him. The Lord said, To what then shall I liken the men of this generation? And what are they like? They are like children sitting in the marketplace, calling to one another, saying, We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We mourned to you, and you did not weep. For John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and you say he has a demon. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, look, a glutton and a winebibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners, but wisdom is justified by our children. Any comments about that section? We'll stop there.